Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank, focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Point number one. Money is good. Point number two, contrary to popular belief, you can't have too much money. Just for instance, when you got it from somebody else. Borrowed money's been driving all the big deals on Wall Street, as you know. Thing is, eventually, you have to pay it back. Today, whether that debt hole might be too deep. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. These reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves. Angie'sList.com. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday today, the 11th of July. Glad to have you with us. You can, in today's world of high finance, find a way to risk your money on just about anything. Whether it might snow in St. Louis on Christmas, or whether the Dow might break 14,000 by Thanksgiving, or a million things more complicated. In a word, they're financial instruments called derivatives. They can get pretty specialized, so focused, in fact, that in some cases they give observers a pretty good idea of which way the market's going. Our case in point today is the world of private equity, and how investors are feeling about them, being able to pay back all the money they've borrowed to do the deals they've done. Not so good, is the quick headline. A withdrawal of liquidity is what one fund manager called it. We've got Marketplace's Bob Moon here to help us make sense of it all. Hiya, Bob.
Hello, Kai.
All right, so help us out here. Why is it that investors are just now starting to worry about whether the companies that are involved in these big private equity deals that we've been seeing might not be able to dig themselves out of debt right now?
Well, Kai, we've been talking for quite some time now, you'll recall, about how much of a glut of investment capital that there's been. Hundreds of billions of dollars floating around out there from various sources, big pension funds, insurance companies, wealthy individuals. Then you've had the big banks throwing even more money on the table. That's provided the powerful leverage. Mm-hmm. Typically, two-thirds of the cost of these big deals is borrowed money.
Yeah, it's almost like money's sort of grown on trees out there.
Yeah, that's a perfect metaphor, actually, if I can borrow on that.
Sure.
Seasons change. We could be seeing the first signs that some of the green might be coming off those trees for these big private equity firms.
All right, give it up. How so?
Well, there's actually this very specialized form of speculating here, wagering on what the likelihood is that a company will be able to repay its debt. There's an index that tracks something called credit default swaps. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be flashing some warning signals today. These speculators are essentially telling us that they see these big loans that are used in these leverage buyouts as the riskiest they've been in at least 9 months. You have to understand here that there's been so much investment capital out there that the banks have been offering great terms in providing the financing for these leverage buyouts. But just as the air came out of the subprime mortgage market, there's growing concern that these companies are being loaded up with so much debt that they might have trouble paying it back. We're talking about debt levels in some cases almost 10 times a company's profits here. Hmm. Dartmouth professor Colin Bladen has been watching the way these private equity loans have been developing.
The debt that has been put on these companies has been put on with very limited requirements about repayment of capital. They can hold on to it for quite a long time. Even payment of interest. If the company can't pay the interest in cash, they can pay it with their own stock. That's dangerous because it dilutes the equity.
On the other hand, this cuts both ways. It's precisely because these repayment terms are so light on the companies that Bladen doesn't think that we're headed for a big fall here. Although just yesterday, the debt rating agency Moody's issued a report that raises concerns about these companies with higher debt being vulnerable to any economic downturn.
All right, so find the light at the end of the tunnel here for us. Where is this leading us?
Well, what does seem to be likely is that now that banks and investors are pulling back, these buyout firms are going to find it more expensive to borrow, and or they're going to have to agree to less favorable terms here, and that could put the brakes on some of these deals. That's something that Professor Bladen at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business told us we should watch out for.
If anything will bring this party that we've seen over the last 2 years to a screeching halt. It would be a dramatic failure along the lines of one of the very big and very prominent deals. That could shake the confidence in this model. So far, it seems to be working pretty well.
But interestingly enough, Kai, these latest worries circulating in the financial community have already fueled some speculation that the big private equity firm Cerberus might have trouble lining up financing for the deal it made to buy Chrysler.
Right.
A spokesman for Daimler Chrysler in Germany says there's been no delay from their side. Cerberus is insisting today that the deal will close as planned in the third quarter of this year. But Daimler Chrysler stock did lose 1.6% on Germany's DAX today. Although one analyst suggested today that that probably had less to do with the chance of this deal falling through than it did with the falling value of the dollar.
A point which, as it happens, we'll be getting to in about, 30 seconds or so. Marketplace's senior business correspondent, Bob Moon. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Kay.
And so on to the dollar. We mentioned yesterday it's the lowest it's been in a quarter century against the British pound. Record weakness on the euro and more of the same today. Worse, in fact. Most of the blame's being laid at the feet of the subprime mortgage market. As Bob alluded to, though, the greenback's weakness is making overseas investors kind of nervous. But how come? From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
The U.S. is still the biggest market in the world. Everyone wants to sell their goods here. But a weak dollar means it's more expensive for Americans to buy foreign products. Mike England of Action Economics says, on the other hand, a weaker dollar means it's easier for U.S. exporters to sell their stuff abroad.
So export growth is outpacing import growth 2-to-1 and maybe even 3-to-1 this year.
Still, he says, don't expect our trade deficit to disappear overnight.
It's going to take a fairly hefty growth rate of exports, however, to catch up with the imports, given that they're at a higher level.
England says the dollar was overvalued. He suspects the government is glad the dollar has slipped away from its highs of several years ago. But Axel Merck of the Merck Hard Currency Fund says U.S. companies may be able to sell more abroad, but a sliding dollar has made them more vulnerable.
Let's not forget that as the dollar is weakening also, the share price has become less competitive as an acquisition tool, for example. A European company can now take over an American company much more easily because it's become very cheap.
He says the U.S. depends too much on foreigners buying dollars to keep the currency high. If the dollar falls out of favor, as it has recently, and investors opt for other currencies,
that on its own will impact the dollar, and that's why the U.S. dollar is reacting so sharply to things like a slowing housing market in the U.S., which may suggest a slowing U.S. economy.
Merck says the government needs to take a more active role in boosting the U.S. dollar. Right now, he says, it's burying its head in the sand. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
So all of that said, what was it that actually happened in the stock markets today? Well, it was a rebound of sorts. There are still some worries about subprimes. And it was an absence of profit warnings rather than good earnings reports themselves that did it. But the major indices ended higher than where they started. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Brace yourself for this one. It's not something you've heard too much of lately. There might be good news on the housing front. Economists at the National Association of Realtors predict home prices will rebound modestly next year, and so will new home sales. Here's the but, though, because you knew there was going to be a but with an introduction like that. The rebound's not going to come until after the first nationwide home price decline in 40 years plays itself out. Marketplace's Steve Tripoli has the story.
Realtors Association economist Lawrence Yoon says the current slowdown is planting the seeds of next year's recovery. Home builders are suffering right now, but Yoon says that means they'll slow construction and remove the excess inventory that's depressing prices. He says new buyers are moving into the pipeline, too.
We have seen rising apartment rents, so that is beginning to squeeze those people who are renting. Also, at the same time, we have seen rising mortgage purchase applications.
Add a strong job market, and Yoon says that means potential buyers are positioning themselves to make a move. But Wellesley College housing expert Carl Case says this is the most uncertain housing market he's ever seen. Case ticks off this downturn's unique mix of pros and cons.
There's no recession this time, and we have low interest rates. We have the subprime debacle, which we didn't have last time. And there's a big psychological dimension. After years and years of rising prices, people are worried about this bubble bursting and are being cautious.
So is a housing recovery lurking in all that somewhere?
If you continue to have employment growth and the economy doesn't go into recession and rates stay low, the demographics are not great, but they're not terrible either, and people are postponing and waiting.
But that's three big ifs. Case can also rattle off factors that might derail a recovery.
We don't know how this subprime thing's going to turn out. We don't know how much of an impact builders liquidating these inventories is going to have on price.
And those two might in turn squeeze consumer spending, which wouldn't encourage much house hunting. So if you're looking for certainty on what's coming next in housing, the economists are saying you can't have any. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
After nearly a solid decade of saggy performance, Levi Strauss is looking a lot more fit. Sales are up. This week, the company announced a 14% bump in second quarter profits. And the good news has sparked speculation the jeans maker could soon be in a position to go public again. That's after more than 20 years as a private company. Elizabeth Wynn Johnson goes behind the seams.
For years, the words Levi's and turnaround have gone together like, well, jeans and T-shirts. The privately held company has restructured, trimmed its U.S. workforce, and moved manufacturing overseas. Scott Tuohy is an analyst at Moody's. He says the company has branched out from its iconic Buttonfly 501 jean, but it hasn't left its rugged image behind.
The key element has been the focus they have on the brand and keeping the message strong with the consumer.
The company's boosted revenue by selling in trendy stores like Urban Outfitters, but sales of Levi's signature brand are down. That's the lower price line sold at discount retailers Target and Walmart. Tuohy says Levi's sell well in the booming Asian market, and a weak dollar has helped drive sales in Europe.
While we think of Levi as an American icon, you know, nearly 50% of its sales are actually outside the United States, and actually outside the United States, they historically earn higher margins on their product, given a more premium positioning for the product there.
The company's got a new CEO, and it's been cutting its debt load. Now the market's buzzing with rumors about a possible IPO. A company spokesman says for now, Levi will stay focused on boosting cash flow and further whittling down that debt. In Los Angeles, I'm Elizabeth Wynn Johnson for Marketplace.
One thing to mention coming out of Washington, D.C. today from the legislative branch of the federal government. The House voted overwhelmingly to tighten up on the review of foreign investment in the United States. Dubai Ports World should jog your memory on this story. Lawmakers want to make sure senior intelligence and national security officials get a crack at proposed deals before they're green-lighted. The Senate's already voted in the affirmative, so the bill's on its way to the president. Not to give a boost to what could be the competition if you're one of those TV people, but News Corp said today it's going to launch its new Fox Business Network October 15th. It'll be competing with GE's CNBC, but left unsaid in the press release was the role Rupert Murdoch's $5 billion bid for the parent company of the Wall Street Journal will play in all this. Dow Jones has a deal to supply journal reporters to CNBC, a deal that would presumably be uncomfortable should Murdoch complete that purchase. One of the world's biggest candy makers will face a few sticky moments this Friday. Cadbury Schweppes is set to be sentenced by a British court for hygiene offenses. Not the wash your hand kind, the contamination kind. The company admits it knowingly sold chocolate after some bars had been contaminated with salmonella. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports on how this case has affected what used to be Cadbury's squeaky clean image.
It would be hard to exaggerate Cadbury's iconic status in Britain. Decades of brilliant advertising have reinforced the almost saintly image. Honest, wholesome, full of milky goodness.
Cadbury's Flake, the crumbliest, flakiest milk chocolate in the world.
Little surprise, then, that the salmonella case has left a bitter taste, says fund manager Justin Urquhart-Stewart.
The salmonella issue wasn't well handled. It's not very good to tell your clients a few months later, yes, we had a salmonella scare, but we didn't think to tell you about it. It doesn't really go down terribly well.
It didn't go down well with the British authorities when Cadbury admitted it continued for 6 months supplying the market with potentially contaminated chocolate. Professor Joe Lample of the Cass Business School says the company's Quaker founders back in the early 1800s would have been appalled.
They were revolutionaries in of what we call today corporate social responsibility. They were pioneers, okay, at a time where capitalism was very much a cutthroat business.
The Cadburys wanted to improve society as well as make a profit. They provided education, healthcare, and housing for their workers. Like other Quaker families, the Rowntrees and the Fries, the Cadburys got into chocolate making out of reforming zeal. They believed in chocolate as a substitute for alcohol.
For the Quakers, it seemed like they're doing a service to society by bringing to the masses, okay, a product which is both wholesome, healthy, and yet maybe serves some of the same purposes, i.e. giving pleasure to people, relaxation.
They didn't seriously believe that they would help wean people off alcohol with chocolate.
They did. I mean, at the time, they certainly did.
Everyone's a fruit and a nutcase.
Cadbury never succeeded in that somewhat eccentric aim, but by the 20th century, the company had become Britain's best-loved candy maker. So how much damage has the Cadbury brand suffered from the Salmonella case?
From a consumer perspective, because it's so powerful and their reputation is very high and it's very trusted, I think in the long term, not much, or probably none at all.
Brand consultant Stuart Whitwell, but he concedes Cadbury's corporate standing has been damaged.
I think it has an impact on the reputation of the company and possibly the management. It's probably saying, look, these guys aren't up to the job.
With its reputation undermined, he says, the board found it difficult fighting off pressure from private equity funds. Cadbury has now been forced to sell off the Schweppes soft drinks company. Whether Cadbury can now survive as an independent entity is anyone's guess, says Jenny Wiggins of the Financial Times.
I don't know whether it will be Cadbury buying someone or someone else buying the company, but it's probably unlikely to remain in its current form in the long term.
The Salmonella case has been a shock, but in reality, say the critics, the days of Cadbury's innocence are long gone, the Quaker idealism long since melted away. The world of chocolate has changed. The very product which the founder considered so virtuous in the 1800s is now widely blamed for helping to cause obesity, that 21st century sin.
A finger of fudge is just enough to give your kids a treat.
In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, smaller, sleeker, greener company cars.
We've seen gas prices rise and fall in the past. It's exciting to me right now that there's more influencing corporate decisions than just gas prices.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial sizzled up 76 points today, more than 0.5% to finish the day at 13,577. The NASDAQ bubbled over 12 points, nearly 0.5% to close at 2651. The S&P 500 heated up 8 points, more than 0.5% to end at 1518. Chaparral Steel pumped up 10.5% today on news that it will be acquired by Gerdau Ameristeel. Gerdau buckled 7.5%. We know that every action has an equal and opposite reaction. Student loan giant Sallie Mae got a lesson in that today. A group of banks and private equity firms has been planning to take Sallie private to the tune of $25 billion, but today, the House voted to slash federal subsidies to student lenders. Sallie now says its sweet deal might fall through. Shares subtracted 9.75%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on international trade for May. Doing any summer shopping? In New York, the nation's largest retailers announced their sales figures for June. And heavy metal fans converge on Seattle for Ozfest. Ozzy Osbourne kicks off a 24-city tour in which all the tickets are free. Headbangers got tickets through sponsor giveaways. Parking, however, is probably going to cost you. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Philadelphia was the place to be last week for education professionals. The National Education Association was having its annual meeting there. A slew of presidential hopefuls made appearances, and the 9,000 delegates debated what the association's policy positions ought to be, including on No Child Left Behind. The White House is pushing Congress to reauthorize the president's signature education plan before it automatically expires in September. And while they're at it, commentator Robert Reich has some changes he'd like to see included.
Worried about American competitiveness? Worry about our schools. The No Child Left Behind Act was supposed to fix our broken system of K-12 education by setting higher standards and requiring lots of tests. But the system's still broken. Of course, some testing is necessary to measure whether students are learning. But the No Child Left Behind Act has overdone it, turning our nation's classrooms into test-taking factories, where the curriculum is how to take tests rather than how to think. The one thing we do know about successful classrooms is they require talented and dedicated teachers. And that's the other problem with the Act. It hasn't included enough money to pay salaries needed to attract the best and brightest into K-12 teaching, especially into classrooms populated mainly by poor and working-class kids. When I went to school, talented women didn't have many career paths other than becoming teachers. But then American society changed, and women could become almost anything they wanted to be. As a result, between 1964 and 2000, the share of college-educated women who chose a career in teaching dropped from 50% to just 15%, according to government data. Many men, as well as women, go into teaching for its non-monetary rewards, but the law of supply and demand is not repealed at the schoolhouse door. If we want talented people in our classrooms, we have to pay for them. The overseers of financial capital, investment bankers and private equity partners, are raking in millions. But the overseers of our most precious human capital, our children, are barely keeping up with what they earned decades ago, adjusted for inflation. Message to Congress: reauthorize the No Child Left Behind Act, but cut back on the tests and include more money for teachers. Message to teachers' unions: if you want higher salaries, you're going to have to accept merit pay. Great teachers should be generously rewarded. Lousy ones should be sacked.
Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. He's teaching at the University of California, Berkeley now. Send us your thoughts when you get a minute. Our website is marketplace.org. Oil's at 72-something a barrel in New York. Gas is correspondingly high, tucked right under $3 a gallon for a nationwide average. That's more than just a pinch to the pocketbook for many, including companies that lease what are called fleet cars for their sales reps and other traveling employees. So one of the biggest fleet managers in the country is moving to a greener company car. Sarah Gardner reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
L.A. native Lisa Valtierra is on the road 5 days a week in Southern California for her job with drug maker Abbott Labs.
I don't use the freeways very much. You know, I'll never get on the 405. That's a kiss of death.
Valtierra knows her shortcuts. She knows her gas mileage, too. When Abbott recently offered her a choice of company cars, she picked a 2007 Dodge Caliber, a boxy little hatchback that's been called versatile, capable, and unexciting.
I chose this one mainly because it was the greenest of the options.
Valtierra's company is one of four that signed on to a program called Green Fleet. It's run by the company Abbott leases from, a huge corporate fleet management firm called PHH Arval, based in Baltimore. PHH wants to manage climate-friendly fleets, so they're nudging corporate clients into more fuel-efficient vehicles, sometimes with baby steps.
Before Abbott joined Green Fleet, their regional manager, for example, could get a Chrysler 300 with a Hemi in it.
Cars with Hemis, those powerful gas-hogging engines, are no longer an option for Abbott's managers, says PHH exec Kieran Healy.
They can still get a Chrysler 300, but it's with the regular engine and it's like a luxury package, so it's got nice leather seats and stuff.
In Abbott's case, about 20% of company drivers are choosing the most fuel-efficient vehicle offered. The drug maker has improved total fuel economy by 4% and reduced greenhouse gas emissions by a little more than that. Healy says another Green Fleet participant, Infinity Insurance, doesn't give employees a choice.
They were driving a Jeep Liberty, and they are now driving a Jeep Compass.
Infinity's gas mileage has improved 26%. Rick Tebay chairs the Fuels and Technology Committee for the National Association of Fleet Administrators.
Everybody's looking at their bottom line. Particularly companies are trying to make their quarterly numbers. They can't afford to have fuel costs ratchet out of control.
Tebay says many companies are trying to cut back on fuel use. Some are switching from 6 to 4-cylinder cars. Others are using GPS navigation systems to find the most fuel-efficient routes. UPS says it saves lots of gas by avoiding left-hand turns. Others are simply checking tire pressure more often. That saves gas as well.
Fuel costs will be typically 10% of your fleet operation costs. And if fuel goes from $2 to $3, then that 10% goes to 15%. And it begins to eat a hole in your budget.
Tebay says depending on the business, switching to an all-hybrid fleet may be the greenest option. But hybrids often cost more up front, and companies can't often justify the expense under the typical 3-year lease. But it's not always money motivating companies to clamp down on gas guzzlers. PHH says its first Green Fleet clients were more motivated by a need to meet corporate global warming goals. Tom Murray is with Environmental Defense, a nonprofit partnering on the Green Fleet campaign.
We've seen gas prices rise and fall in the past. It's exciting to me right now that there's more influencing corporate decisions than just gas prices.
PHH may just be starting to green its fleets, but Environmental Defense sees potential for a huge expansion. GE, the biggest fleet manager around, is set to acquire PHH later this year. If environmentalists can convince GE to sign on as well, they say they could potentially steer a third of the country's company cars in a greener direction. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note before we wrap things up today. Long the runner-up in the world of social networking, Facebook's turning out to be more than just your average college networking site. Traffic has soared 89% over the past year or so, which of course means investors are seeing profits in its future. Never one to miss an opportunity, Silicon Valley venture capitalists are deciding now's a good time to invest, not necessarily in Facebook, but in developers that program for it. $25,000 to $250,000 for developers to create applications that work specifically with Facebook. Not necessarily good news for Rupert Murdoch, who owns the competition MySpace, although he's busy with that Wall Street Journal thing. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow jumped 76 points, 0.5%. The Nasdaq sauntered up about 12 points, nearly 0.5%. The S&P 500 gained 8 points, that is 0.5%. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Phil Richards, Joel Stein, and Tim Bomba are our engineers. Next time, nothing gets you sales like really good PR.
You're going to be much more apt to listen to that fashion reporter in your daily newspaper who says, I've tugged, I've pulled, I've looked, I've investigated. This is a great shirt.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.